Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Have you ever thought about a world in which truth completely breaks down? Truth is essential to our understanding of the world as Christians. When he was questioned by Pilate at his trial, Jesus said he had come to testify to the truth. That truth was the truth about the kingdom of God. In a sense, everything about God is wrapped up in the truth that was embodied by Jesus. And Pilate's response? What is truth, he asked. As he said, he found nothing against Jesus, but nevertheless allowed him to go to his death. You might say that Pilate's question, what is truth, could well be echoed by us in our society today. We live in an age in which on one day the US president will say one thing, he'll contradict himself, the next even correct himself, and then double down and say exactly the same thing the next day. That president is so afraid of contradiction, or people who might question what he says, that he actually calls the free media in his country the enemies of the people. That's the sort of thing that you hear in totalitarian regimes. Australia is not free of this type of debate either, of course, and for us it's not just claim and counterclaim about the facts of the matter, just as in the United States. It's really about the intent that lies behind the words that are used in public discourse. We talk in Australia of dog whistle politics, when one thing is said that really signifies another. You can find examples of that right through the debate over refugees or even ethnic crime gangs at the moment. Professor Nick Enfield is a linguist at Sydney University, and he's part of a thing called the Post-Truth Initiative. He calls the events that we're going through at the moment truth decay. Nick Enfield, welcome to Open House.
Thanks for having me.
What questions does linguistics help you to answer that, let's say, just simple fact-checking doesn't when it comes to the truth?
Well, fact-checking, in a way, goes to the core of the question of truth in that it takes a proposition that you might make with language and it goes and asks, you know, is this true or is this false? And that, you know, is obviously an important function. But when you hear somebody speaking, for example, in a speech, a press conference, a conversation, you get a lot more information than just the content of the propositions that they make. So you get information about their tone of voice, you have an idea of which words they're emphasizing, and perhaps most importantly, you get the messages that are implied by the things they say that, you know, a fact checker cannot actually go out and test. So, you know, a good example would be the sort of veiled threat. You know, I think that some time ago now, Trump did the famous threat, I think it was with Comey, saying, you know, I hope you can make this thing go away. And, you know, that's like the famous sort of gangster threat which says, you know, it's a lovely family you've got here. It would be a shame if anything happened to them.
Yes, yes.
So if a fact checker went and looked at that statement, they'd come back and say, yes, it's true that it would be a shame if anything happened to this person's family. But that, you know, of course, doesn't address the real intention behind what was said.
That example, because it's quite a helpful one, it's very accessible. It would be a shame if anything happened to your family. How would a linguist parse that, analyse that, to get to the perhaps the meaning behind the statement?
Well, you've got to look at the fact that human beings are really, let's say, designed, or the way that our minds are designed is that we look into the messages that we get for the meanings behind them. We really are sort of tuned into the intentions that underlie other people's actions. And language is a part of that. So there's a field of linguistics called pragmatics where people sort of go beyond the literal readings of the words and we say, okay, well, what would be the implication here? And a useful concept here is accountability. So I can say a sentence like that one, it's a shame if it would be a shame if something happened to your family. Now, to you and me, you know, we can recognize that as being a threat. And so, in a sense, you're accountable for having, you know, threatened me in some sense. But if you go to court, you're not actually accountable for having threatened the person because you didn't actually say it in words. And so, you know, in that domain of linguistics, it's that very interesting gray area between sending a message but not having officially sent the message. So, you know, the kind of analysis that we do really looks at the common sense understandings of language, but where those understandings kind of slip through without being on the record.
So does something like that help us to work out what which Donald Trump was speaking the truth when on one day he said, I can't see why it would be the case, brackets, that Russia was involved in the election, and then he said, oh, I tripped over a double negative. I meant to say, I can't say that it wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, well, you know, that's an interesting one. The problem that underlies this, of course, is, you know, we can never really know what somebody meant to say. We can never really know what someone's true belief is. And so there's a distinction between what a person really believes when they say something, whether they think the thing is true or not, and whether that fact happens to also be true. So that helps you to distinguish between lying, that is when you say a false thing and you know it's false, and, you know, just mistaken speech, right, where you say something that's false, but you thought it was true. So there's a problem already there, which has got to do with being able to get into people's minds. Now, in this case, Trump has claimed, you know, okay, when he said that the first thing, I don't see any reason why they would do it. That's not what he meant, and he actually meant the opposite. That was the claim that he made. Now, as I said, we can never really verify what his true belief is, but we have a lot of evidence to show in that the case of this particular man that he's really not very interested in the truth in terms of how he's being understood. I'm sure he's interested in the truth in a great number of ways, but in this case, I think it's transparently, you know, the case that he's simply trying to, in that case, do what his aides were asking him to do in order to, you know, do a bit of damage control.
Is there anything else in the words around, the context around the first statement, I can't see that they would have done it, that would give you the indication that that was a true statement of his feelings at the time?
Well, you know, it would be wonderful if we could have reliable detectors of you know, of lying. This is a field that linguists have been interested in, and especially psychologists have been interested in for decades, probably forever, really. I mean, language is an incredible thing in that it allows us to lie, and, you know, it's really quite unique. And on the whole, you know, it's a dangerous aspect of what language is, the fact that, you know, we really don't know if people are on the level with us.
But yeah, just to pull that apart a moment, you can make a sentence with language that says something like, everything that I have just told you is a lie, including what I just told you.
Right. Yeah, well, these are the famous sort of paradoxes that language brings in, and you know, language is really quite special in this respect.
Yeah, because you can't do that in mathematics.
And, you know, and I think in animal communication you also can't do it. So, you've got interesting deception in animal communication. Of course, language is a form of animal communication, but it has this very special property of being, you know, of allowing us to claim truths through making propositions, through asserting that certain things are the case.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, we can actually test whether those things are the case or not, and that allows us to be able to say, well, this person lied, that they had a belief and they said something that actually contradicted that belief, and they wanted us to believe the thing that wasn't true. So that's always a danger with language, that people are not telling you the truth. But in reality, you know, we are talking to people who we talk to every day. We don't really have much motivation to mislead people. You know, you tell me the time and, you know, I'll look at my watch and I'll tell you, you know, it's 10 to 3. Why would I tell you a time, you know, that's false? Well, sometimes, occasionally, somebody might do that for some sort of bad reason. But on the whole, language only works because we use it in a way that is genuine and we trust the things that people say. And that's exactly that whole assumption, that whole sort of ground rule of language use is what allows us to lie occasionally. And, you know, unfortunately, we see it kind of rupturing at the moment in public discourse.
Nick Enfield is our guest, from a linguist from the University of Sydney. Well, let's talk about public discourse, because we enter, and yes, it is dangerous when we enter the era that's been named post-truth, meaning, I guess, that the use of language can't be relied upon to tell us not just what's factually true, but what is going on in the person's mind, communicating the message. It might be the President of the United States speaking about denuclearization or some other very big subject. We just don't know anymore. What are you showing in your linguistic research?
Well, I mean, I think what it really boils down to is the question of trust around language use. So, you know, language is a social phenomenon. It's something that arises in social interaction. It's something that's maintained through social interaction. And all of our social life is conducted by means of language. And so there's something, you know, really quite crucial is that because of the fact that, it's possible to lie through language, we need to have that trust maintained so that we can actually kind of get things done and not be misled by other people and so forth. So when we analyze the way that language is actually used, that's when we start to understand somewhat about kind of the sort of problem that the post-truth crisis is in. The real problem with post-truth is that you're looking at interactions and assertions that take place at a great distance from their addressees, right? Normally we're sitting face to face, we're having a conversation. But the real problem with the kind of post-truth era right now is the use of language at a distance, particularly through things like, well, the media, obviously, but social media and more the sort of popularly accessible media that the internet really kind of affords.
So if we look at social media, I think you've written somewhere that we're reading people's emotions rather than something that's factual about what they might actually believe.
That's a big part of it for sure. And what's interesting is that, you know, when you're getting into public discourse, you're not only sending ideas around and sort of trying to convince people of things, but sometimes that takes a back seat, and the real purpose that you have is to identify with people and to support people and to show your allegiance with people. And, you know, language is a very powerful tool for doing that. So we do it unconsciously with things like the accent that we speak with. You know, it reveals, you know, where we grew up or maybe our level of education or all sorts of things. But when we accept or support or repeat, you know, or click on a message, whether it's true or not, we're showing that we want to support it. And what happens in public discourse a lot nowadays is that the desire to support a person or to show allegiance with a person outranks the desire to, you know, be concerned with the truth or falsity of an assertion. And that's where you get into to the danger space.
Yes, and I would want to say, look, as you know, Nick, the concern of this program is to look at life with a faith-based lens on and then, if possible, point at hope. I saw something that was an example of what you're talking about on Facebook the other day. Now, someone with whom I'm sort of passing friends on Facebook had clicked like and then shared something that someone else had shared with them, and so it goes on. Exactly an example of what you were saying. They wanted to show affinity for this message. And here's what the message was. And it was a meme, and it was deeply offensive. So I apologise in advance for what I'm about to say. It had a picture of a rind of bacon, and it said something like, "Bacon should not be banned just because it offends Muslims." Now, that's offensive at a whole range of levels. It's offensive not just to Muslims, but also to Jews and other people who eat kosher or halal food. It's also a false proposition. There's a false proposition there, the suggestion that someone wants to ban bacon, because I've never seen such a I don't think there is such a threat of banning bacon anywhere. And it's mixed with this truism. Oh, yes, we do understand that, some religions don't eat that meat. And then it said, and this was the really damaging part, share if you agree.
Right.
And so people are sharing it around the internet, and suddenly a lie is being propagated, not just an untruth, but something that's bigger than an untruth, because it has the capacity to damage the very fabric of our society where people need to get on with each other, where we ought to respect each other. Is that what it is to live in a post-truth world now?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an interesting case because you've got these various implications that get made through a statement like that. Now, you could agree with that statement. You know, you could say, well, you know, something shouldn't be banned, whatever the thing happens to be, because it offends people. You know, one might agree with that point. But what's interesting about the example that you gave is that saying that has the implication, just as you noted, that somebody's out there in society suggesting, you know, that should happen. And what happens is people pick up on the implication rather than the content, the literal content of what was actually said. And then they might go and have a conversation with someone and say, hey, you know, that people want to ban bacon. And that's how you get the rumor mill going, and that's how you get conspiracy theories going. And, you know, once that's happening, we see example after example of, again, real-world consequences coming into play. You know, you've got people harassing people, you've got people targeting people. It becomes really a diabolical problem.
Nick Enfield is our guest from the University of Sydney, professor of linguistics there, no less. In the United States, then, to return to that, I noticed that even though the president will contradict himself from one day to the next and then change his mind back again, and it's clearly evident if anyone who's following events just pays the most passing interest to it, he's self-contradictory, and therefore he'd say, okay, well, nothing he says can be believed. Except that the studies show, and there was an Ipsos poll this week in the US that showed that his core constituency is still prepared to believe him when he talks about there's no collusion in the case of Russia and his campaign for the presidency. And so they'll come with him almost whatever. Now, is that an example of what you talked about before, that by showing an endorsement of a person, you buy into the truth they create, and that they indeed may use linguistics to shore up their supporter base, to bring them with them on some pretty outrageous propositions?
Yeah, I think that's the case. You know, the idea that they believe him is an interesting kind of proposal. So I'm not sure that they actually really do believe him, but what I think is that they simply don't care.
And maybe they believe in him.
Yeah, and what they're really saying is they're willing to accept what he's saying. And there's a lot of analysis around this, which is that, you know, a lot of people really don't care, but they want to support him. And oftentimes it's a sort of a negative motivation there, which is that they really want to do whatever is the opposite of what, you know, for example, the left in the US would want to see happen. So you've got a very sort of tribal motivation among a lot of people. It relates to a really interesting point that has come up quite often in the discussion around post-truth, and you know, that is around this idea of BS. I'll just use that term.
Thank you.
You know, this is actually a term which we all use, but it's become used in philosophy with a technical kind of sense. Now, I mentioned earlier about lying. Lying is where you know what the facts are and you intentionally try to deceive people.
Right.
But the idea of BS is, you know, you say statements and you have absolutely no interest in whether they're true or false. You just say the thing that happens to be what comes into your head or is the most useful for the current purposes. So that's what we really mean when someone was, you know, spouting BS. And in a way, you know, I think that's very much what Trump is doing. He just says whatever he wants. And fundamentally, he simply doesn't care, or he doesn't really have much interest in whether these things are true. Or perhaps it's really more about his audience. And his audience, just as you've noted, similarly, just don't really care if it's true. Now, deep down, I think people really do care about certain truths. And for example, with Trump, I mean, there either was or there wasn't collusion. There has to be a truth on either side of that proposition. And it's something that certainly he cares very much about. So he's strongly motivated to deny that. But with other things, you know, he'll sort of flip-flop and say one thing one day and one thing the next. And I think that the deal he's got with his constituency is essentially that he's playing a different game with language. The game is not, you know, trust me, I'm telling you some facts here. It's I'm saying some cool stuff that's going to annoy a lot of people. Come along with me.
Yes. That's probably one of the best explanations of it that I've heard. And look, finally, I'm just intrigued by the fact that together with another researcher from, I think, the Netherlands, you once won an Ig Nobel Award. So the Ig Nobel Awards are kind of awards for improbable research, aren't they? Nothing really improbable about what you did, though. You proved that the word, huh, just that simple, H-U-H, huh, in its various forms, exists in how many languages?
Well, all human languages was the claim that we made, and we haven't had it falsified yet.
There I go. Amazing. Right. But leading on from that, I gather that you went on to do a paper saying that on average, every 90 seconds we, in normal conversation, correct something that we've said. That's a nice idea, because a conversation is a transaction between you and me, and if I'm monitoring you and the way you're hearing what I'm saying, then I'll correct the misconception, a bit like the way the governor corrects the speed on a truck, you know, to make sure that my meaning is clear. So the correction of misspeaking is actually an inbuilt part of the human language.
Yeah, absolutely. This is what we've worked on for several years on languages around the world, and it's really quite an important finding that is not had much of a run in linguistics. Linguistics is mostly concerned with history of words and the structure of sentences and so on. But what we did is really looking closely at conversation, you know, in the to and fro of conversation, the moments go by constantly, and the conversation can go in any direction at any point in time. So if you have missed what the person said, or if you get evidence that they misunderstood you, you better act on it right there, right then. And we see in all languages that people have these systems. They can say things like, huh, what, who, and get the other person to backtrack immediately and solve some kind of problem of understanding. And so it all goes back to this kind of set of ground rules for using language. You make sure that we're on track. You make sure that the people involved are sort of up to date with what the other one is saying, and it's all part of this highly cooperative game of using language. It's something that I talk about quite at length in a book I published last year called How We Talk.
Sounds like it's a good one. Who's the publisher of that one?
Basic Books in New York.
Okay, we'll look it up. How We Talk. Well, Nick, thank you very much for being with us on Open House.
Thanks very much for having me.
Professor Nick Enfield. Part of a panel discussion, by the way, on truth decay, to be presented in Sydney next month at the US Studies Centre in conjunction with the RAND Corporation. You can find out about that at posttruthinitiative.org, posttruthinitiative.org. And the idea of post-truth, the undermining of truth, is indeed the end of civilization. And I'm not saying that, I'm saying that with great depth of feeling. And when you undermine biblical truth, then you undermine civilization and society and personhood.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.